This podcast contains material that some listeners may find distressing. Content includes explicit language and themes related to workplace bullying, harassment, sexual harassment, intimidation, stalking, physical and sexual violence, discussions relating to self-harm and suicidality, disordered eating, other mental health issues, sexism, racism, and homophobia. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Behind Blue Doors, a podcast where women and allies have the right to speak their truth and share their stories.
Good afternoon, everybody. Today we have Roger Chafin, who is the previous chief of Calgary. He had a 33-year career with Calgary Police Service, 7 years as a deputy, and his last 3 years were as chief. And we were actually very surprised to have Roger reach out to us here at Behind Blue Doors podcast. And I'm not going to lie, at first we were a little thrown back and unsure of why. Why would he want to talk to women who are up in arms about what's happening in the police culture? So upon a discussion yesterday with Roger, it became very clear that this is a very important conversation that needs to be had and heard by many. And we found it very refreshing and appreciated the perspective. And we want to share it all with you. So I'm Lee, and my co-host today is Mo. Roger, thank you so much for joining us. Would love to hear about some of the, well, we want to hear a lot from you. And we have a lot of questions, but we also wanted to hear about how, you know, why did you reach out to us? What is it that you needed us to hear or that you thought was important to bring to the table?
Well, I think, I became aware of the efforts of your podcast, and these conversations have been going on for some time. Obviously, now there's lots that have emerged in this world of sexual harassment and workplace behaviors in policing. But I just thought this is the opportunity to present itself at least to provide some more context for your listeners about how these issues look from the perspective of the executive looking into the organization. And then probably to talk a little bit about sort of my journey through this issue and, you know, this sort of understanding of the mistakes that are made from the executive level, the, you know, what you've learned from that process, some of the opportunities going forward that we could help, you know, with groups like yours that want to advance this discussion, to want to see really meaningful reform and feel that you're not sort of connecting to, you know, the legislators or the executive staff. I thought at least I could offer some honest perspective. It won't be a defense of behavior. I'm not here to tell you or anybody else, you know, that they're wrong and we had it all right. I'll actually probably tell you the opposite, that I accept responsibility for the culture of our organization. And we made a lot of mistakes along the way around trying to address this issue, but it's important to continue the conversation.
Absolutely. And that's really appreciated that, you know, I think naturally for a lot of us that have been through very unfortunate incidences within the police culture, to have someone in the executive position actually recognizing that you're, you know, I'm not going to defend the behavior and that there does need to be change. It's such an important conversation to have. Now, my understanding is when you became the chief, that you weren't necessarily the person, well, first of all, you didn't even think that that was going to happen because you were pushing reform. Is that correct?
Yeah, the process for hiring or selecting a chief is an odd one. It takes quite a bit of time. My particular path is probably, you know, I don't know if it was unique, but it was, you know, my intention as a deputy, I was a deputy for an extended period of time. And I got to the point where I was becoming disconnected from the path of the organization. I was troubled by its culture. I was troubled by, you know, where we were at the time and the risks that were emerging. And you don't sit as a deputy. And if you become disconnected, you have to make the call. And to me, the call was, I'll step aside, let the chief find somebody else that was, you know, maybe more aligned with their way of thinking, and I'll just go off my life. But in that process, the chief at the time actually stepped down. He made a decision to move on with his life. And so this opening was created. And so that's the first time really in your career, after 30 some odd or 30 years or so, that anybody ever says, hey, how are you considering being the chief? It just doesn't occur to you. You're just so busy working. You don't really think about it. At least for me, I wasn't thinking or grooming myself for this position. So I kind of still parked it. I said, I'm really not that interested. I don't think I would be someone they'd be interested in, because I don't think, like, you know, the sort of the norms, I don't fit sort of this pattern we've had for the last several years. But something weird occurred, and oddly, they asked me to come in and talk. And I became sort of concerned that what I believed was occurring in the process was likely a repeat of the last several years. Someone who would like to do more of the same. And I thought the harm that would create to the organization, not just its reputation, but the members who serve in the organization, if these serious issues weren't addressed, if we weren't able to go back to the public with a commitment to be accountable and transparent with the issues of the service, at least if I went in and talked, I would lay this out for the selection committee and the commission to say, in case you don't know, here's my perspective on the risks, the things that are going on right now. And again, like you said, I knew I was saying that I was probably committing suicide of some sort. I'm not going to.
So, Roger, sorry to cut you off there. I just want to recap that you were concerned looking at the perspective or the person that was going to take on the next chief position was potentially going to lead the service down the same path. Is that what you're concerned about when you were looking at possible candidates?
Yeah, the same, along the same route that we've been on that I've become sort of disconnected from. And I just,
and why were you disconnected? When you say I'm disconnected, I'm looking at this, I'm kind of picking you apart because I'm looking at it from the perspective of us looking up to the executive level and watching kind of what we see goes on. So when you're saying to me, you were disenchanted, you didn't want the next position of chief, I'm sitting there going, yeah, right. Everyone does at that level. Do you understand what I mean? So explain why you were disenchanted.
Well, honestly, I can say, and this will be a weird thing, is actually most people don't want that job. It's, if you're the deputy, you've risen very high up in the organization. The next position, you wear everything. And there's not a lot of people who actually want to take on that responsibility. So it's actually not that uncommon that people at that level aren't seriously interested in it. But for me, it was more of a case of saying, look, as a deputy, you are directly employed to the chief. And if you can't fulfill that person's vision, mission, or its direction honestly and sincerely, then you really shouldn't be sitting there. You shouldn't you shouldn't try to frustrate that person. Even if you disagree with them, you shouldn't just be there to fight. You should be, after all things have been exhausted, you should step aside and let someone else take on that position if that was the case. So it wasn't a planned pathway. It was just more of a case that I heard what was going on in the organization. I talked to people. I could see the dysfunction that was occurring, the sort of rise of challenges that were all confronting us at the same time, both in public trust and confidence and in the culture of the organization. And so these are things that if we don't confront them, they will become a huge disaster downstream. There's all sorts of consequences for not addressing these issues.
What issues specifically are you speaking of?
You start to see this intersectionality of issues, like when you hear things like low morale in the workplace, and then you see these incidences of these use of force problems. One of the areas I paid a lot of attention to because of my area of responsibilities was things like performance management, and I could see that less than 30% of the organization ever received a performance assessment in the last couple of years. People just stopped doing them because they didn't think they're important. They didn't think they're necessary. I could see training standards weren't being followed. I could see all sorts of high risk areas were being unattended all at the same time. And that was leading to the kind of performance and behaviors on the front line that tend to make the front pages of papers. Officer involved shootings, misconduct, criminality, all these things are starting to bubble up and become a systemic issue. And then if you added to that the concern about culture and bullying and harassment in the workplace, you could see all this happening at the same time and an area that needed to be focused on and addressed. And I thought it needed to be addressed not in terms of virtue signaling and nice speeches and a couple policy statements, but needed to be addressed in the light of day. It needed to be done publicly. It needed to be brought forward. We needed to go through this experience and, you can't start this off and have your first goal to be not have any harm come to the chief. You're going to have to be able to say the executive is going to have to own this issue, publicly confront it, and start working through problems. And it's not going to be a fun time. This is going to be a very difficult time for us working through all these issues and trying to refocus the organization into more of the expectations of modern communities.
So, Roger, in the Calgary Sun, you had Zach Lang did an article I'm sure you're familiar with, and it did talk about your tenure as chief, and that it was that you had explained it was plagued by a myriad of issues, most notably a toxic working culture, claims of sexual assault, sexual harassment, bullying, and intimidation within the service. And in the article, they discussed that one of the ways that you looked at breaking down those barriers, that you said it was by bringing up gender, and that you felt that it was a starting point for respect in the workplace. And you were quoted saying, "It's intimate, it's before us all, and it includes literally every person in the room. It's interesting because the more you talk about it, gender diversity issues and gender harassment, other people start speaking up saying, it happens to me too, no matter how you identify yourself," you said. So I would love to ask you about that. So what were these, what were you seeing in regards to sexual assault, sexual harassment, and bullying in the workplace?
Well, I guess that's a good way to frame all that. It's what you see largely were a few things. Is A, most of the senior staff didn't understand it. You'll really sort of appreciate it for its enormity.
Didn't understand it or didn't want to look at the ugly elephant in the room?
Well, it could be both, right? I mean, my experience ordinarily, developed my own hypothesis that people just simply didn't understand what harassment was, what bullying was, what sexual harassment looks like, you know, how it feels to people, the impact of going through something like that. And how disconnected we were from real solution. You know, there wasn't really any particular avenue for real solution. There was always a reactive mechanism we could do if someone so grotesquely misconducted themselves that we could, you know, run them through the Police Act hearing system and, you know, try to get rid of them that way or something. But realistically, it does nothing for the people in the workplace. It does nothing for the confidence of the people who are looking for change and looking to be heard and to be listened to. So as you, like I said, as you started this process of talking, and we did begin this awkward journey really focused on gender, you know, particularly how women in the workplace have been treated. But then the more you talk about it, the more other people had the confidence to put their hands up and says, well, me too. That's going on here as well. I feel the same way. I feel, if it's by ethnicity or if it was by sexual identity, if it was any sort of these sort of features that generally people feel, you know, marginalized from, they all start putting their hands up and say, you know what, we're all going through this. So, and it does start to speak to just how much culture needs to be understood and unpacked before you start running around with a tiny little scalpel thing. I'm just going to fix sexual harassment and everything will be better. Serious issue needs to be addressed, but you know it's a much bigger issue and it needs to be looked at much more systemically. And it begins with leadership, as it begins an issue of how are we leading these organizations and why do we allow this to occur and how are we going to substantially alter this?
I think I just want to reiterate, Roger, your point is basically, just for the listeners, is that you're saying that everything is interconnected. So if we can't just take one topic, such as sexual harassment or systemic discrimination, cut that out and hope that once it's gone, it's going to fix all of our problems. I think that's what you're trying to say, is that it's all interconnected, correct?
Right. And then obviously then that's still, you're still, you know, beholden to make sure you do address these issues of harassment and bullying and sexual harassment and sexual assaults. Knowing it's a huge problem isn't some sort of abdication from your responsibility to deal with this particular issue. It just pointed out the enormity of the challenge and that the no silver bullet solution is going to be available to you. You simply are going to have to work to unpack this this entire mess while you're sorting through these problems.
So here you are, you're chief now, okay? And you're sitting here and you know all of these problems are happening. So you mentioned that you started at your executive level and started having these difficult discussions. Tell us about that. Like, that was your first step. And then what did you do? How did you unpack this problem?
Well, you can appreciate, you know, we're a bunch of men in the executive room, and it was the chief of the day who, we were observing what was happening in the RCMP and the public outing that the RCMP was going through about these very issues. And the question was asked to us as deputies is that going on here too? Do we have a problem here that we don't know about? So we
I find it crazy that that was actually a question.
Well, you know what?
Like, I get that, like, because the women and those who have experienced what we've experienced, like, there's, to us, like, how do you not know?
We've been screaming it for years. Sorry, Roger. I'm just going on Lee. I mean, we've been yelling this for years that there's a problem. So I don't know how. I agree with Lee. It is laughable that this was even a question.
Well, it's good, and it's part of this the discussion. What how this looks from these other seats, these other perspectives. You know, this is one of the risk points or one of the mistakes that are made. Is the absence of complaints a sign of a healthy organization? If people aren't complaining, if you're not seeing these things, is that in itself enough to say nothing to see here, move on? And I guess we are kind of in that loop. We just weren't hearing a lot. We weren't seeing a lot. People weren't coming forward a lot. So therefore, there must not be an issue. We must be the shiny organization amongst all those who are having troubles. But at least I'll give
was
you...
Sorry to interrupt again. Were you ever considering the fact, Roger, that possibly the executive level wasn't hearing it because A, they didn't want to hear it, and B, it was being covered up before it got there?
No, I don't.
I would say that people aren't reporting is more what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Roger say that there wasn't, and I think we know that there is a very small percentage of women who. And men who will come forward and report because of the culture of you will be a rat. We talked a bit about that yesterday, Roger. You can go ahead and expand. Well,
on the term rat, I do find it, that's one of the funny parts about police culture, and it's probably in every organization. Terms like rat are prison terms. They're not the terms of a professional organization or professional people. It's an odd how policing is chosen to adopt that language in talking about such things as people stepping forward and people fulfilling their moral and ethical obligations under their oath that they swore to serve and uphold the law, that somehow the term rat becomes their language. But you know, the what happened there, I want just to be clear, is I do think the chief of the time felt there's something going on. There's more to this than we know, and wanted to begin at least a directed, purposeful mission from the executive. Let's go find out what we don't know. And because it is possible for organizations to mistake the absence of complaint as that of a healthy organization, if they're not complaining, there's obviously nothing going wrong. What we learn later, and what we certainly all should be aware of now, that people don't come forward, not because they're happy, because they're afraid to, or there's no point in it because there's no trust to come forward. And it's unraveling that starts you on the right path about being honest enough to say, we actually do have a senior culture that discourages people from stepping forward. And, you know, so we had to start that process. And that.
Where do you think that comes from?
Well, that starts from, that's likely historical, cultural within the organization, is that people, you know, in the working areas of the service, there's a political reality to policing, the hierarchy of policing. So if you worked for a sergeant that you wanted to complain about, you couldn't even go to that person's boss because they're likely friends, or there might be a, you know, power imbalance there that you're going to get exposed on. So you sort of learn this. Again, it's this almost this prison culture. You learn this rationale that mind your own business, just shut your mouth and keep moving forward. Don't sort of stick your nose into things that don't belong to you. And isn't that what, you know, prisoners talk about? You know, so we inherently, by our inactions and our inability to address the foundational problems, foster the growth of that. And because people stay in these organizations for decades and decades, you actually develop this as an inherent part of culture without trying to address it, because we've all accepted it. We've, like, this is part of what I say, you have to accept responsibility for culture. In an organization I was in for over three decades, is that I was part of that. I would have been part of that discussion or that language. It didn't happen by itself. And you know, the need to reform or to make serious changes isn't flavor of the day. It is critically necessary, and it's going to be critically painful to do it.
So how do we do that?
I just wanted to touch on when you said, inaction. When I think a lot of us, and I speaking for myself and people who have been through this sort of what we feel has been an abusive system and how it's been dealt. For me, a lot of what you are calling inaction has been actually purposeful action against me or these other people, you know, where when you speak the truth, because it doesn't bode well for the culture that you're working within, then you become the target. And then, you know, you're using your police, the Police Service Act to shut people up, shut victims up from speaking. So just the word inaction seemed to me, you know, I think a lot of times it's not inaction, and there's a lot of malicious action that takes on behind the scene. And I'm not saying that is how you functioned as a chief, but I wonder, do you see that? Do you see that is how a lot of people perceive what's happening?
Well, you're right. It's a fair comment, actually. The inaction is only part of it. It's the, I guess where I was sort of landing a little bit was all the things that you walk by in the office, all the behaviors, all the things as a informal leader or leader in the organization that you just laugh about or walk through is implied permission to continue and let these problems grow. It's and this is what the foundationally what we're all guilty of. The behaviors, the retaliatory behaviors, or the impact for people having come forward and how they now experience their career are oftentimes purposeful. People are intentionally upset. They're bothered. They're feeling, how dare she complain about me? I'll get her. And they're able to enact both sort of informal mechanisms like being ostracized in the workplace or not being supported out in the workplace, or they're able to diminish people's ability to apply for lateral transfers or for promotions by rumor mongering and things like that. There's all sorts of insidious behaviors that can go on that actually crush people and that don't get addressed or don't even get talked about, don't get evaluated, and therefore it becomes acceptable behavior, I guess. And then there's obviously the things that you're experiencing are intentional attacks. People who intentionally go out and to make a public point of, I'll show this person who where the power lies in this organization. And those are what bothers me about that more than anything. As much as it bothers me, if we take ourselves back to what we're supposed to be, this is a public profession of enormous authority and enormous impact on people's lives. And because of that oath we swore, because of that becoming a public official, and because of the enormity of your outreach, the expectation is you will perform at a much higher level than the rest of the community will. That the expectations of you is not to be just like community, but to be that those people that rise above community norms, that simply are immune to these, or as much as possible, to these human fallibilities and these weaknesses and these sort of things that occur like that, and these terrible behaviors, is that how could you ever?
But knowing that that's embedded in the culture, how do we address?
Well, one thing I noticed,
like what are your thoughts on how to address that?
One thing I noticed, and the people that worked around me will be tired of hearing this, but if you go out to any recruit class and have a look at them, although there's issues that happen in recruit training as well, but by and large, they're there to learn, and they're being told about integrity and ethics and values and morality and all the sort of the higher arching goals of policing, and they're really sort of enthused by that. And then if you go to their swearing-in ceremony, where they're actually sworn in and given their oath, at least in our organization, you would hear a really emotive and impactful speech by the issuing justice who is going to deliver this swearing-in. And he or she will talk at length about the importance of this role, about the meaningfulness of this oath, about what this means to be an officer, and what the expectations are of you in community. And it's all very terrific. Remember, none of these people have ever policed yet. They've just graduated classes, and they get this really impactful moment about morality and ethics and values and about your role in community. And that's the last time they'll ever hear that. For 30 years, you'll not hear that again. Like I said, I walked around our organization. I said, show me anywhere in this organization, on the walls, in anybody's office, anywhere, the Oath of Allegiance. And what sort of struck me a little bit on that, and I'll pause here, was, you know, I live in a small town, and the pharmacist in our town has that oath above his workstation, as if to say that's the thing that drives me every day, is the importance of that oath. Yet in our organization, it is invisible. It's not there. And there's a message there about What are we really doing here? What are we really leading our members through?
Roger, I can honestly say that when we're listening to you, Lee and I definitely remember that day. And then from there on, I've worked in the recruiting area, so I have sat through many of those speeches. And I agree 100%. And I think the hardest part for someone like myself or Lee is that we still believe that we should be rising above. So it's really hard when we're speaking out in our own organizations because we believe that there should be a standard and we're not the norm. We're the voice that's unreasonable, that's being difficult. Does that resonate with you at all? Or
Absolutely. I mean, for me, my particular hypothesis on this is these issues do transcend just about every organization in this country and likely in the United States as well. And it would be intellectually bankrupt to suggest it's about we've hired the wrong people. It's really more of a case of how we have constructed and led these organizations over time to create these toxic environments. It is a call for a wholesale change of leadership, a wholesale change of organizational standards and expectations. If you're not going to, you probably, I don't want to disparage the work that goes into things like mission, vision, values, but you probably all know them. And the times if you've gone for promotion, you may have had to repeat them. But do they really inform you when you go out every day, when you go into the office, when you interact with the public or your peers? Is that the thing that really motivates you? It probably isn't. They're probably empty words on a wall someplace that make up for a nice poster, but they don't really.
Well, it definitely doesn't mean anything to you when you see no one above you acting accordingly.
Well, I looked at this. I talked to our organization over and over and over again in small groups and at the district level or at small team levels, and just ask them questions and try to get their feedback on these issues while I was going through this. But, I went through every person in the organization as often as I could. And, obviously I missed some people, but for the most part, I'd ask this question: what did your oath say? And not one person could answer that question. Said, what did your, do you know where to find the oath? Not one person could answer that question. That's a warning shot that we are missing the point. I sort of use this as a talking point with my executive, but when we drive out of one of our detachment or district offices, there's a gate everybody has to drive through, and there's a sign on the gate that would say something like, drive as if everybody's watching you because they are. And I said, it's interesting. We have to warn officers not to drive like idiots. Don't break the law. It's an implied understanding. We know you're going to do that, but just warning you not to do it. I said, we've been sending such a wrong message. Rather than reinforcing values and your ethics and this morality involved and the high order that the community expects of you and to encourage you to strive for those every day, we actually sort of kind of give you a nod, wink, wink, don't get caught doing anything stupid out there. And that,
when you look at recruitment, just to add perspective to what you're saying, you take young people that they do want to live up to that standard and they do want to take the oath and they have ethics and integrity and everything else. We really do hire wonderful new people. We do. And I think we all start out that way. But when you look at the way services then train these people and not only train them about use of force and criminal code and everything else, but the culture, how we bring them through the culture, which is exactly what you're talking about, that wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We put every single one of them through the same machine, the exact same machine. We take all these individuals, let's say, put them through the exact same machine and hope to spit them out the same way. But didn't we hire them for their individuality?
Absolutely. I had the opportunity to test that hypothesis. When I was a deputy, the chief at the time was concerned that we were training people to be hypervigilant, overly violent, that kind of thing. And so I was lucky. I had a clinical psychologist on staff, and he had good backgrounds in as a statistician and as well as an Olympic athlete. So he actually walked through the entirety of the recruiting process, including all the filters and screens we do through application process, and then followed that class through recruit training to try to evaluate at what point do we take that person that you described and change them into somebody else? And interestingly, his feedback to me was this, is that the recruit training is actually quite good. So it's quite solid. The pedagogical methods are very sound. They're very forward. You know, so he could not identify any issues there other than perhaps some of the timing of different types of programs. He said, but he actually followed a group of them back out into the field. He says, where you see the change happen is when they get to work. And it's the distance between what people are taught and what actually happens in the workplace. And that gap becomes the beginning of the cultural shift. And you likely have heard this, and most people, police have heard this before, is, I won't use the real language, but screw what they taught you in training. We'll teach you how we really do things out here. And that begins the unaddressed, unintended consequence of now a different culture than what you promoted at the beginning.
Yes, Roger, I agree 100% is that disconnect between when you graduate and when you get out on the road and the different messages.
I could actually expand on that a bit too, to say it's not just our organization. I had the good fortune of working with, on a national committee, working with a professor out of Carleton University, a fellow by the name of Stephen McGuire, who was commissioned to survey and research the ideas of professionalism and integrity in policing in Canada. And he got over 10,000 respondents to participate in this program. So, and this crosses municipalities, federal policing, provincial policing, and is able to really dive into the details of these questions about what happens to the integrity of officers. And if you were an executive, and I would hazard a guess that most ignored the results of this thing. They may have read it. They may have read the executive summaries, but they didn't really dive into the intentionality or the meaning of this research. But it did show clearly that on integrity measures, on the ideas of what integrity means to an officer, what integrity means to how they perceive it, what they expect of it, it's at its highest point in recruit training. And within about 6 years, it starts to go at its lowest point that it'll ever be in an officer's career. So they stop believing in the organization. They stop believing in the relationship with the community. They stop believing in each other. Like the questions like the willingness to report. If you saw something in the organization, would you report on it? Do you believe your peers would report if they saw something? And all those hit very, very low marks at around that 6 to 10 year range. And so who becomes officer coaches? Who do we start promoting? Who are the informal leaders in the organization? If that is true and that message is true, it's the people who are at the lowest form of their belief or their own integrity measures. And that is not a condemnation of them. That is the fault of leadership, that they're not engaging members. They're not sort of developing more trust and confidence. They're not listening more often to what they're experiencing and how to address these issues as they start to develop.
Roger, do you think that that is the case of not rewarding the right behavior as well? Or A, not rewarding the right behavior, but B, also not disciplining the wrong behavior?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good point, is that, again, the behaviors that you allow to occur in the workplace unaddressed sort of become the standard. So they're like, and we all know, it may not sound like it, I guess, but I am a huge proponent of policing and the people who serve in their organizations. They do tremendous things in community, and they're inspirational people, and they had been to the end of my career. But we tend to hide behind them as if you can't have this discussion unless you're going to insult all the high performing people. The culture is more about the things you don't do, the things you don't address. And what does it say to the high performing people when you allow misconduct or sort of dysfunctional behaviors, or if you allow the sort of things that were experienced in some of these previous podcasts, if you allow them to persist? Those are all good people who sat on their hands and said nothing when Lee needed support. These are all those high performing people who chose to look away or lose their memory. These are not the behaviors of, or the expectations of a high functioning profession. These are street level behaviors that should never occur, but we allowed them to develop because we didn't have performance standards that made a difference. Right. We didn't have the courage to have difficult discussions with people. We didn't actually have the right areas to measure. I'm going to guess this is our service. I'm not saying all services like this, but when's the last time you heard anybody get a negative performance assessment?
Oh, nobody did.
Oh, I did.
No, but you got it in retaliation.
Yeah.
You were being retaliated against. But generally, I believe generally that most of the services, they want to be friends with their coworkers. So when you look at supervisors don't want to give poor performance appraisals. They want to win the popularity contest.
Well, and this is and I would agree with that. And I think that's, you know, I don't mean it to be quite so insulting, but if you are going to be in a position of leadership and your ultimate goal is your popularity, then you are setting other people up to fail. You're not setting yourself up to fail near as much as you're targeting them to fail, because you are going to eventually walk someone down a path where they are going to fall on their face or do something terrible. And the whole time you will hear, well, all I thought was I was doing a great job. No one said anything to me. I thought I was supposed to be doing this. And
that's right. And there's no paperwork, right, Roger, to back that up. There's nothing to say that there was a problem.
And that goes on. I had the same problem, you know, even right to the executive level. When I was telling my senior staff, I said, when we look at transfers of people this year, I said, I want to see honest assessments on everybody, not, you know, sort of, you know, drive-by assessments, but really detailed assessments. And we knew people that were low performers and they were struggling and we had a hard time placing them. But when that commander gave that person a glowing rating, I said, congratulations, he doesn't go to the end of the list. He goes to the top of the list, and you get him first. Because you just, if you're not going to be truthful, then you need to accept and own this issue.
Well, and the PSA also helps to prevent any negative behaviors from coming forward. We talked about this yesterday with the, you know, the 2 and the 5 year, and then you get the get out of jail free card. For listeners that aren't in policing, when a police officer is disciplined formally or informally, if it's informal, they're disciplined for 2 years, meaning they can't move up the chain or get promoted for 2 years. And if it's formal, it's 5. And, you know, we've talked about this yesterday, Roger, where in any other profession, depending on how bad the behavior was, you would be fired.
Yeah, I've often thought that, you know, and we could have a whole nother podcast just on the Police Act. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you're any other employer with this much information about the misconduct of an employee, you wouldn't be having much of a conversation. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure how yours are structured, but in our, where I was, we had this largest group, obviously, were sworn officers under the, you know, under the Police Act, but we also had many civilian employees who were under QP, or they're just under sort of another management exempt regime that weren't protected by or covered by unions, but they weren't covered by the Police Act because they were civilians outside of the Police Act. They do anything near like this, and that process takes about 2 weeks before they're gone. It's just like there isn't this other sort of quasi-judicial court-martialing system. It's simply a case of, we have enough evidence here to suggest your performance is so antithetical to this organization and to our premise that we're going to have to part company with you, and you do this sort of dismissal without cause and look for a notice period to, you know, to sever with them, and off you go. It's difficult, but that's just, you know, it's a risk level that you're no longer willing to accept, particularly when it fell to bullying and harassment. Is here you are, you're the executive making these grandiose statements about your commitment to this thing, and you're going to let managers just do this. So you see one come across your desk and you say, okay, let's look into it. Let's make the move. And this person's got to go.
And it's so unfair, Roger, and it's so unfair to the victims. In these cases of harassment and discrimination or complainants that have come forward, when they see these, I mean, in our cases, it was men who continue to rise up the ranks despite the fact that their behavior, you know, it's indefensible behavior. And we're ruined by it mentally and ostracized, especially in Lee's case. And these individuals continue to rise. And you're right, in the civilian world, that would not happen.
No, and like anybody you talk to, and there is a substantive difference, I guess, for the audience to really sort of ground on, is that a police officer himself is not a traditional employee. They're not an employee like an employee for a private sector company would be considered an employee. They, you know, they largely don't fall under the various labor codes. But the Police Act governs them because they're public officials, because they're subject to frivolous and vexatious complaints, that they have this other system around them to protect them from frivolousness, but I just don't believe that needs to protect them from behaviors in the workplace as well, or these sort of, you know, in any other case, and any other employer would say, look, we've tried remediation, we've tried warnings, we've done all these things, but at the end of the day, the person's behavior persists. It is so antithetical to the organization, it's so detrimental to the health of the organization, public trust and confidence, that we're just simply going to, you know, say end of the day and let's separate, move on. But that idea of separating for suitability is not really present across the country in these various acts because it was never really considered. It was always considered everything would go into a hearing, everything would be a police act misconduct issue, and somebody other than the executive can make that decision about whether that person should stay or go.
So Roger, just to bridge that gap, when you talk about, you know, those things occurring, for instance, Roger, as having been a chief and having been, you know, a part of the Ontario Chiefs of Police, or sorry, the Canadian Chiefs of Police, do you see that the PSA is being used against, like they're using it instead of using it to hold the predator or abuser's behavior accountable, they're using it now against the victims to say, well, you tagged your service in a tweet. This, you know, that's disparaging against the organization. It's disparaging against the chief. And my sincere point of view is me telling the truth about what's happened to me isn't disparaging. It's the truth. And if you stopped allowing this disparaging behavior to happen, I wouldn't have to talk about it. But it's being used against, and it's not just me, there are numerous women across Canada in police services who are being PSA'd for reporting sexual harassment, you know, for, you know, speaking a certain way about a male supervisor. We're getting PSA'd, but the male accusers, predators are not. I need to hear your thoughts on that, because I know women listening who have been through this, we don't understand why we then become the target.
Again, probably a whole other podcast just on that question, but I'll go through it as succinctly as I can. Is you're right. Process abuse starts to become a huge issue for anybody who dare come forward, and it's based on a few things. A, the way the legislation is established, if you and our organization, you're an officer complaining about another officer, your one and only route to receive justice, if that's the right word to use, is through the Police Act. There is no other mechanisms. There is nothing else available for you other than to go into that hearing. And remember, the Police Act process, or the Police Services Act process for managing allegations of misconduct, are still rooted in this court-martialing, this paramilitary court-martialing system. So it's very constrained, very structured. And part of that structure is going to be, you've just complained about, and when it's a peer within your union or your association, you just complained about a member of a working association. So they're going to be defended by that association. And rightfully so, that association has the right of to, you know, the duty to fair representation and needs to support members on, you know, who are alleged against. Except now, who is supporting the victim when it seems like all the energy is going to supporting the accused? And what happens in a hearing is the usual, is rather than deal with substantive facts, is you seek to diminish the credibility of the complainant. And here you are, you have someone who's subjected, you've been subjected to severe harassment or sexual harassment or sexual assault. And now you're on this, you're getting grilled by the very group that is supposed to be supporting you. And the person who's presiding over that is no longer your executive or your chief. It's some other independent body who only can listen to the ideas of credibility. The standards of findings in a professional or Police Service Act hearing is slightly above that of, you know, the civil case of beyond reasonable doubt, but the balance of probability. It's a little bit higher than that, but because it's based on some levels of precedence and things, but they start to look at it clinically. Did I hear enough evidence that the complainant provided, the evidence the named officer provided, and where do I go with this? They're not thinking about culture. They're not thinking about, you know, the cost or the impact to you beyond this hearing. They're just simply fulfilling their regulatory obligation to have conducted this hearing. And when it's all said and done, you go back to work, this person goes back to work, and even if they were found against, they might get, you know, lose some pay or get a written warning or something, but the issue of the harassment stays.
So Roger, what you're saying as well is they're not thinking about the impact that the outcome of that trial has on the entire organization either. So what messages is it sending to the membership about behavior and how you're allowed to conduct yourself?
They're completely correct? Disconnected. The outcomes of those hearings are often completely disconnected from your human resource regime. Like even the information to go back and forth doesn't necessarily happen. There's often firewalls set up so information from a professional misconduct.
But Roger, we know kind of like what we were going back to about prisoner talk is that we know that the information from the outcome of those trials and what's going on gets back to the membership. I mean, come on, if it's completely informal, yes, but there's like this underground information that gets back. So essentially, the outcome of that PSA still has major impact on the behavior going forward of the entire membership. Also,
it's one of the immaturities of these models is that Canadian policing is going through is because our substantive role is, you know, is to investigate things criminally and apply the criminal burden of proof to, you know, I'm using the parenthesis investigations, they tend to want to do that to all types of investigations and put that standard to everything. And so I look at this, I look at someone who had the courage to come forward, someone who experienced one of the worst things they'll experience inside a workplace, and that the courage to come forward is now being put to the criminal burden of proof. And so where are your witnesses? Where's your video? Where is your corroboration, any of your evidence? And we don't have any. All you have is this happened to me and I want to be listened to. I want to be believed. All the other person has to do is say, no, it didn't happen. And where are you? Like you talked about this in yours. Where were all the witnesses?
Well, they were all protecting themselves at the time. Well, and still. And, you know, I'm not so naive as to think that there wasn't conversations between the chief or executives at the time with one of the witnesses and who got a situational amnesia and then was promoted to inspector shortly after that amnesia and then was put in charge of internal affairs overseeing this case. I mean, the cronyism in all of this is, you know, it's blatant, it's obvious, we know it's happening, and then you make a grievance about it and it's investigated internally and then we didn't find any wrongdoing. Well, of course you didn't, because the grievance is against your executive teams.
Still the shocking thing to me about culture and when you were reliving that moment was that not one person came forward first. Not one person stepped up and said, I saw that yesterday and I am obligated and duty bound and morally directed to have raised what I just saw happen yesterday, and I need to say something. If not one person does it, and then others start to hide behind, you know, lost memory or fear for coming forward, it tells you all you need to know about the toxicity of culture. It tells you that is no one should go through that in any format, in any part of community, and not have people come forward, let alone in policing, where these are the people who are supposed to be the high functioning, the high order of justice, the people who are more apt to bring forward that their oath said that they'll stand up to and enforce the law without exception or bias. Not unless, of course, it's at a party with your peers, or unless one of your peers is something silly. That then you can give a break to, but everybody else you can't. Like that's the shocking piece. If you want to step away from all these things and say, if you want to know if your culture needs to be addressed, it's that. It's when people don't come forward when they've clearly seen wrong.
Well, instead, I was questioned on the stand about why I didn't you know, in prelim, defense counsel went after me about not reporting it, the victim, that I had a duty to report. And I said, well, no, under, you know, the Victims Act, like I didn't, which seemed to be lost on him. But again, it was put back on me. I should have. But the reasoning for me not coming forward at the time was for the obvious reasons of what's now happened.
But is it not the same why wouldn't the same criteria be applied to you as we would apply to perhaps those who, you know, in the community who suffer sexual assaults or domestic violence? Do you expect that the victim is simply going to put their hand up and say, hey, this happened to me? Like there's a mass amount of indignity and humiliation and pain that goes along with the experience. Yet you want to fall to policy at this point and say you're obligated to. The problem, and that's where I think people tend to fall behind policy statements.
If I may, in Lee's case, what's more shocking is the fact that these people, you said it's shocking that no one came forward, but I find what's even more shocking is we all know the people that didn't come forward, and we all know that they have all since been promoted. I think that's even more disgusting. Like, you go through all this as a victim. Nobody listens to you. Everyone knows the story. They all know who was there and who wasn't there because that's the rumor mill. And unfortunately, rumor mill is often very truthful. And then these people go on and become even bigger and more powerful. And Lee keeps losing and losing and losing and watching this happen. And talk about mental stress and being re-victimized. I think that's the shocking.
Yeah, I would not disagree with that. I mean, sort of all the layers of disappointment and these incidences like Lee had to experience. I've seen it myself. That this, as soon as people get uncomfortable, as soon as people try to protect themselves, all this high talk about, you know, about improving culture and about supporting victims and about advancing a higher form of workplace seems to go out the door for me first, protect me first.
I have a little offshoot story here that goes along with what you were saying exactly. I was a victim of workplace harassment myself, and a coworker of mine, a male coworker who I thought very much of, said to me sort of in private, you know, Mo, I'm sorry that this has happened to you. And he says to me, I don't know what I would do if it was my wife who happened to also be a police officer. Well, my husband's also a police officer and a supervisor. And I looked at him and I said, you know that my husband would stick up for your wife. And he looks at me and he almost couldn't look me in the eye. And he goes, yeah, I know, but I'm going for a promotion right now, Mo. I just can't. Like, I'm sorry you're going through it, but I'm going through promotion. And that's exactly it. It's like, you know I can't do this for myself. And you can't really blame the guy. Like, I understood where he was coming from.
I don't know. And that's a very honest assessment that you got. Honestly, that's probably the most honest assessment you're ever going to get, because it's sort of all the filters are off now. I'm going to tell you that I don't want to step my, but that's what I mean from an executive level, what you stop hearing. There's this big gap that occurs when you're on the executive team, whatever it looks like in your organizations, and all the high-mindedness and policy development and strategic planning and all that goes on and all your intentionality. You may think because you've done that, that somehow that's affecting the front line, but it's not, because what people experience and what their real lived experiences are a big distance away from the policy statements and the speeches given at the executive level. Like, these are, and there's, it seems like in most organization, there is this invisible barrier between the intentionality of the executive and what actually is going on at the front line that seems to be hard to break through. And, you know, those are.
Roger, yesterday you talked about how you brought in a third party to interview all of your executive level and talk to them, and you put them through some pretty uncomfortable situations. Can you talk about that and what the result of that was? How did that all work out for you?
Back to how we started this discussion was, you know, when the chief of the day had asked about, you know, what's going on with the women in the workplace here and let's look into it. We, as a group of executive, we decided to sort of craft up some sort of unprofessional survey structure to go out and survey a whole bunch of women in the workplace, get their feedback. And that went very poorly and for lots of reasons we can discuss later, but it didn't go well because it certainly, again, pointed out to the theme more than anything is stop asking us these questions. I don't want to get pointed out. I don't want to be, you know, seen to be a complainer. I just want to be left alone. And so you get this weird response. So in that process, I came across a professor at the University of Calgary who was speaking on gender harassment and workplace harassment issues as part of her academic credentials. And so I sought her out.
This is when you were chief.
I was a deputy then. So I sought her out and explained to her where we were and what was going on. And she had, what I didn't realize is she already had some depth of research and experience on the culture of policing. And, you know, the first question she asked me is just tell me you didn't survey these people. And, you know, I did. But at any rate, we went through she spent quite a bit of time with me to try to explain to me what it is you're dealing with, what this culture really is, what it really looks like, what the problems people really are experiencing, what it's like to be a targeted person in the organization based on your gender and stuff. So it was like she spent some time with me slowly walking me through this and helping to sort of provide more integrity to my thoughts on this issue as opposed to just my hypothesis. And in that process, I invited her to come in and speak, not to the whole organization, but just our senior team. My belief was, I think with some of the mistakes we typically make is we'll bring in an expert and mandatorily make everybody take a 30 or 40 hour course and check off, say, yeah, we did a piece on workplace harassment, therefore we are safe. Let's move on here. But I said, if they don't believe that we believe that, if the frontline says, yeah, you gave us that course, what about you bastards up there? You don't do any of this. You don't even believe this stuff. You lose any traction you get out of training. So I said, rather than do that, let's actually start at the senior side and get some feedback. So she came in and I'll give her the world of credit because I remember her to this day and I can still talk to her today if it's necessary. And but she came in and she didn't come in to be gentle and kind. She came in as a solid academic, but also as a bombastic feminist, and sort of laid it out as to what this looks like and what the problem really looks like. And as I was listening to myself, and I'm thinking as she's going through points, I'm saying, yeah, I actually believe what she just said. I think I've actually done that. I've actually behaved that way. I've made those mistakes. I've done these things. But I'm looking around the room and looking at the visceral discomfort that everybody's going through. They're looking at the floor. They're turning their backs to her. They're looking at the ceiling anywhere, but like they just want to be anywhere but here right now. And to me, and it's just my view of the world, that told me all I needed to know about how far away we are from understanding this issue. You know, when we talk about virtue signaling or giving nice statements, you really don't even understand the enormity of this problem and the extent that this is, you know, is cancerous in our organization and destroying people's careers. So that began a whole process of working through learning and understanding. And what I found very interesting about it to me was weeks later and months later, people would come to me, my executives have come to me and tell me how much they disliked her, how much they disliked what she said, but they could repeat almost everything she said. And I thought, well, isn't that fascinating from an adult learning standpoint? Is you remember 3 months later, I get everything she said. Like it resonated with you and it was visceral and made you uncomfortable. And that, pardon me?
Sorry, Brené Brown talks about how in order to learn, you have to feel uncomfortable as an adult. That's where your best place comes from.
Right.
Right?
Instead of armored leadership like we do, having daring leadership, which is what I would say you were attempting to do, Roger.
Well, but if your intent as an executive at any role there is to be popular or to be political, then you'll never get traction on these items. You do have to be emotive and honest and willing to accept all the slings and arrows that are coming with opening this up and walking down this road. But if you're willing to do it, you will set a pathway forward for the next iterations of leadership better at this.
But Roger, honestly, why would anyone want to? Like when you look at policing and what we've talked about for the last hour and yesterday and how people rise to the top. And yes, I give you huge kudos, don't get me wrong. But when you look at, unfortunately, we're talking quite in a majority. Why would they want any of this to change?
Well, I would actually maybe reframe that a little bit is why do we keep incestuously just laddering people up the chain? Why don't we look for leadership that comes from other organizations, from other walks of life to bring in fresher perspectives, to disconnect themselves from history?
I know, but we're talking about we as a culture of policing. And when I'm looking about the people that benefit off of this whole process and how it all works, what we're discussing, and I look at the executives up there, I'm thinking to you, like, I'm with you. I think we should change this. But do you really think that the people at the top feel that way? Because it, the way I'm seeing it from my perspective, looking at them, is they've benefited from the system. Why would they want to change
it? Yeah, but I was there too. And I do know a lot of executives, both current and past, who think more progressively, who are more committed to the idea that we have to disconnect from our past and sort of model that we're doing that's out there. But you're right. You're up against an enormous amount of inertia from culture and history.
And you look at the military, right? They're going through this right now where they want to change the culture and they're trying to find a leader to change that culture. But unfortunately, because all of these people that are part of that organization,
like stakeholders and so forth,
and stakeholders and have a piece of this and have benefited to some degree, depending on where they are in that organization, they're all afraid to come forward because of the history, because we talked about there's 30, 35 some odd years in one organization. And how much baggage do you have from when you were maybe 25 or 27?
Well, that is true. I guess what I'd offer as a somewhat a defense or a different take is you'll get nowhere by putting lipstick on that pig. If you are just simply going to play at the edges and write a new policy statement or give a new speech or create some new mechanism in your organization, but don't really seriously intent on dealing with culture, then you'll simply just get through this in a window of time.
And I think we're both agreeing the same thing. We're both saying the same thing. What I'm saying is that's a really, each and every person at that of executive level, when you talk about this cultural change from your perspective and not putting lipstick on a pig, would actually really have to look at themselves in the mirror. And I'm sure some of them have, based on the conversations that you've brought up. Or have had opportunity to have. You said yourself, these people keep coming back to you and they remember everything that was said. Well, why do you think that is? Because they're looking at themselves in the mirror and they know they don't add up or they benefited somewhere along the way. And so what I'm saying is, of course they don't want to change any of this. Why would they? Because it might come out that somewhere along the way, either they buried their head in the sand and pretended that something didn't happen that did, or they were involved in something that happened that shouldn't have happened. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right, like, on both counts. I mean, that's like I said, I agree. It's, you know, when we are, you know, always rallying to say we need to hire reflective of our communities, that also means we hire all the ills of humanity that come into policing. But again, I would say we over decades have fostered that culture. We have not only okayed it, but we've promoted to it. We have rewarded it. There's people over time in all of our organizations who have elevated themselves, even despite the fact they've been, you know, done terrible things to people. So that is a culture we develop. My point will still be is that, like, my take on it, well, I didn't go into that role for self-martyrdom. I didn't say, like, I'm going to go in there and see how much pain I can cause to myself. But I also went in and said, look, I believe in the profession. I believe in the potential reform. I believe we can get on a better footing. But unless someone is willing to absorb some of this pain and get this ball rolling and start down this path, it'll never happen. If everybody's just going to try to be popular, this will never, we'll never make any positive steps. And so I was willing, and I made a point of it to the commission and to anybody I talked to, I was willing to be unpopular for having done these and having made these statements. And you know, those people who worked around me, it, you know, some of them made them unpopular as well and made life uncomfortable for them. And it was difficult. It wasn't a very fun experience to go through, but I still passionately believe the potential exists for reform. But if all you're going to do is tinker at the edges, then you are simply saying, I would rather be popular or rather just get by on this issue as opposed to meaningfully address culture. And
I absolutely agree. So what happens? What do you propose digs deep, that gets down to what can actually change? You know, we need to talk about HR, PSA, you know, all of those things that need to change to actually change the culture.
What would be the first thing you'd change, Roger?
Well, from if you're an executive or anybody that leads an organization, what you hold important is what's getting measured. So when you deal with your commissions or your boards and they're talking about finance and audit, which is critically important, and they're talking about, you know, the regulatory regime around complaints and about community, you know, concerns and crime stats and things like that, that's why you spend so much time there. But why things like workplace culture and behavior really seem to take a tertiary or lower role is because they're not measured and they're not deemed one of those things you can quantify. So if I was to say, if you really, and it's added to the fact is chiefs are transitory. They come and go. The commissions are volunteers and they come and go. So the long-term traction tends to get lost in the wind with other sort of more emerging issues that might occur. Like lately we're dealing with systemic issues of racism, but this, it's like that's the only problem the organization has. I would say from a political legislator standpoint, from those who are rewriting their acts or haven't even considered rewriting their acts, it has to be reconsidered along these ideas. If to hold an organization and its governance accountable, it should be in legislation. It should be clearly stated that you will address workplace harassment and workplace culture. You will report, or you will have some sort of standard to which can be audited or followed to say that you are following the leadership or direction of the government who authorizes your organization.
And who would do that audit, Roger? Who, what group, what entity would do that audit? I think that's the biggest problem is who besides the police polices the police?
Well, but this is again part of the complexity of that answer is the boards and commissions are representative of the community in theory, right? They're not part of the police. They're meant to be independent of them, and they're meant to be the authority that responds to the community, not to the police service. So there has to be more.
But
that's part of it. The legislation has to put more guardrails on the commissions and boards to do your job. I know you're volunteers, but
like on your boards, do you have, or your, are you guys called a commission? Ours is the police services board, but do you have your mayors or a mayor sitting on your police board?
No,
we have both of our, we have two mayors and they both sit on our police services board, and it happens and it's in Toronto as well. They have the mayor of Toronto is on their police services board. I mean, everyone is in each other's pockets. Like, how can you possibly have any sort of real transparency or, you know, trying to say that you're representing the community? Well, no, you're all helping each other's agendas.
Well, it's a funny thing because structurally, the police service is independent of the mayor. The police service, the service in the provinces are their authority comes from the province, not from the city. They're not part of the municipal governance acts. They're independent of all their arms of service. And so in theory, the mayor would have no more voice. But we know who pulls the purse strings. We know who sets budgets. We know where the operating budgets come from. So the mayor, although he has no regulatory authority over the police, has the, you know, the ultimate final say because they provide budgets to the commission through the commissions or boards. So they, like in ours, there's two counselors that sit on there, but there's a dozen other people that sit on those things, and they are more representative of the community. My concern for them is there's no particular guidelines or standards for them to follow on this issue. Like mine made it a point. I work with them and I made that commitment to be transparent and public and honest with them about workplace harassment and bullying. And they took steps to identify like a 7-stage reform piece they want to see happen. I want to see these 7 things happen in your organization around structural reform. And they took a proactive step towards to say, we're going to step through governance and we're going to make an operational demand of you. And so in our history, like more, our executive was pissed that we are allowing the commission to interfere with operations, but I actually agreed that the commissions need to take an active role in accountability for this thing.
But Roger, we did discuss this yesterday as well, and you brought up a good point, is that all these people, whether they're paid or whether they're volunteer, when they're sitting on the board, they have a public face. And it's like Lee says, you know, they're lawyers, they're whatever they are in their own community, and they want to be successful. And they have their own agenda. And, going up against a police organization or holding a police organization accountable doesn't sound like necessarily a very good move on their part for that
agenda. I mean, it's a little bit different in Ontario, because in Ontario, the boards are the employer. So they have a bit more intimate role. But I can reference mine. I do think that their own political agendas are problematic. I think the courage to stand to, when they took ownership of an issue like this and wanted to show themselves as leading the charge, then they also became lightning rods for complaints and dissent, and their own credibility was being challenged. And when you do that to a volunteer who's has a profession in another area like law or something like that, is how comfortable do you think they are accepting criticism that might affect their actual careers or their political aspirations? So what you get is people who, for a while, they stood with you, and then they'll start to back off because it's more than they're willing to absorb, more than they're willing to accept. And I think it's structurally part of the problem. But part of that issue, I think, is the governments themselves, that ministerial branch that oversees policing, public safety and justice, could take a much more directive role with these boards to make sure that their political agendas don't sway them from their objectives. This has to be something that's more than just a line item report, that it has to be the culture of the organizations, and the toxicity of culture has to be a long-term priority. It can't just be flavor of the day and get lost in the newest issue that'll come by 6 months from now or 6 weeks from now. These things have to last through chiefs. It has to last through the boards, because you guys know, you all work in organizations. If you see a chief ask for something difficult or, or crazy or out of the norm, most of the answers is we'll outlast him or her. All we have to do is just sort of put up with this for a couple of years and they'll be gone and we don't have to worry about this anymore. It's because of that transitory nature. So the consistency of strategy, the consistency of reform has to last, pass through whoever sits in those chairs. And the only way to do that, I think, or in our current structure, is through legislation, that the government has to take a long-term view of reform and accept the leadership for that and say, we're not going to sit back anymore and just wait for the next disaster. We are going to be more directive as to what we want to see happen and how we're going to account for it.
Sorry, how do you think the PSA needs to change so that it protects whistleblowers and those who are, receiving abuse from within the workplace?
Well, I think to ask a victim of harassment or sexual abuse to only tell them their only access to justice or reform is through the Police Act misconduct process is asinine. I think it's so disrespectful to the victim that it offers no opportunity for the victim to feel safe and heard in a process like this. And clearly, these sort of court-martialing regimes had not considered this issue. The world has changed enormously in the last few years, let alone the last 30 or 40 years. And a lot of these acts are sort of based on sort of really historic principles of paramilitary justice. I think, what I went through the problem here is what happens to an executive, you find a different way to do these things, a more, obviously the first opportunity when these things start to bubble up is to be remediative, is people to learn from their behavior, to stop what they're doing, try to find a better way to behave in the workplace and, to return safety to workplace. So you find these other mechanisms to try to do that. But as soon as I think the working associations or unions think that you are disguising discipline through another process, then they have a arbitrated case to make that you can't do that. You can't set up some other regime to deal with it. It only should be dealt with through the Police Act. So they have this automatic defense to any sort of innovative ways to sort of bring social fairness and equity and justice to the people who suffer such indignity. And I think I think that has to be written into legislation. I have that the chiefs have to find or utilize other modes of investigation and decision making outside of the Police Act to deal with these issues particularly, and to allow for you to speak up, to know that it's not happening inside the organization, that there won't be retaliation, that they will suppress or limp or reduce the likelihood of rumor mongering or people disseminating information, that it's, and then somehow the commissions or the boards are then answerable to that entity, is that it stops being such a, they're just going to report to the chief and tell them anyway, that it has to be some sort of independent way for which the outcomes of these processes are understood and learned about, but not interfered with. And to say that's unrealistic is silly. I mean, we have a psychological services branch at the place I used to be with, and that level of independence exists for them. That if you have a mental health concern, there is no avenue and no mechanism for which anybody in the organization can understand what was being said in that process, what the outcomes were of that process, or what issues people are dealing with. It's meant to be private and secure to protect the dignity of people who are suffering from issues. Why can't things like this have the same protections and the same kind of independent reviews and outcomes, so you can make informed decisions, but you can support victims? You don't just support victims by having negative outcomes or offenders. That's a much bigger process than just punishing somebody. I'd rather, larger goal is you need to eliminate that sort of toxicity in the workplace.
So I have a question. So when you were the chief and you were attending the Canadian Chiefs of Police Association or Canadian Chiefs of Police meetings and stuff, were these topics about what's happening within the organizations and women and so forth, were these topics ever discussed? Do they get discussed? Is it something that they're trying to address, or did you see none of that?
Yeah, CCP was, I was there, so I was an executive on there. So yes, I raised these issues. And I would say, I had no particular resistance to this discussion. I know that at the time, the executive director of the CCP started up a gender equity committee that didn't just, sought out police leaders in Canada, not just police executive, but other women who are particularly focused on these issues and wanted to give them voice to help inform CACP better about what's going on and what should be happening in a language that maybe they would understand. So I thought there was an openness to it, but what they're doing currently, I don't know. I couldn't really attest to, did it get any traction or go anywhere? But I was telling you this yesterday, and won't be popular. My take is on the vast majority of executives are intelligent, thoughtful people and don't want problems. But it's much different to say that than it is for you to actually take substantive action to correct those things because of the significant amount of blowback you will get for being unpopular. If your unpopularity makes you unpopular, if that unpopularity drives your sustainability from the board or commission side to say, look, we'd like to keep you, but you're so unpopular right now that we're going to have to get rid of you, then it is somewhat committing career suicide if your goal is to be there forever. And I told you this the other day, I was quite willing to accept that responsibility to say, I'll absorb that if it only got us moving in the right direction. And I do think we got moving in the right direction. I do think there was much we could have done better and there was much more to do. But I think, somewhere in the leadership realm, people have to be willing to say, stop hiding behind all the good people and say, we have a problem. Your defense of the organization and its history because of all the good work we've done, it's terrific and it's noble, but you're simply pulling a veil over everybody's eyes if you're not willing to deal with the difficulties of culture and not willing to accept the criticism for doing that.
Well, Roger, it's really refreshing to, have your perspective and to hear compassion and empathy and concern. I think that's what I've, would have loved to have seen from the chiefs that I have been under and had to work for. I know that many of the women who are in this fight right now, and when they speak about the executives and what's happening to them, the way they're handling it is just so, so wrong. And it's unfortunate that you're still not in a place where you can help make change. Can you just, we've got like a few minutes left. I'd love to be able to just wrap up with you telling us, what you're doing now.
Mostly hiding from humanity. I just, I serve on some local boards in the city, some that sort of do a lot of work in the space around community wellness and health and things, the Health Foundation and the YMCA and the Homeless Foundation, just to help them. I think I remain interested in this idea of reform. I'm part of a coalition of academics and community leaders and some experts in the idea of how reform could look and the need to create a more community-driven pursuit of reform. The idea is of perhaps national standards, a place where evidenced research and best information could land at a regulatory level to ensure all organizations are following a certain path and doing the right things, not just simply doing what they think is necessary, but following best evidence of a proper path forward. And I guess I need to say that coalition, I will say this, and Lisa, I know she works with you, she knows of this group. It's worth pursuing. It is not easy. It's going to be difficult in the community side, but there is a better way forward. And the only other thing I would add, and that always resonates with me, is that there's lots of people on our organization who came forward who likely felt I didn't do enough for them. And all I can say for all of you who go through that, that is likely true. In retrospect, you could always do more. You could always think about, is there more you could have done, or could you have acted differently in those situations? Could you have pursued different outcomes? And there needs to be the ability to first understand where you are and start learning and start looking for a pathway forward, as opposed to making excuses and thinking it's someone else's fault. This is not the problem of bad people. This is really persistently poor leadership that allows this to occur.
I have one question for you before we end, sort of a hypothetical one. So, Roger, what would you do if you were still chief and you found out that one of your officers had set up a podcast to deal with all of these issues?
Well, I'll use a large organization like we were. So you're charged with $500 million of budget every year and all sorts of enormous issues. So if someone wants to set up a podcast, I would have a hard time imagining there's any policy, defendable policy in the world that could stop that from occurring. I would probably listen to it myself, or have some of our strategic communications people listen to it to tell me, are there risks or concerns or anything immoral and unethical behavior that's going on, or something that we need to know about. But by and large, I'd like to believe that we'd be supportive of that attempt to communicate. Like I said, you can't part, and I don't say that as what I would have done. Like I told you before, I promised to do this in the open. And that, when you do that, you're going to make that commitment to transparency and accountability. That's not just me, that has to be for everybody. That this ability to speak and be heard and to share your thoughts actually should be part of a healthy pathway to reform. And so I can't say I would have done anything more than try to understand it more, try to see what's going on, and listen to it. The biggest thing you could do is listen to these things and listen to what they're saying. Get over yourself, get over the criticisms, but listen to what they're saying. And if you can do that as an executive, if you can get over it, then you'll hear some things that might change the way you think about the world.
So Roger, what would be your advice for Behind Blue Doors?
Don't stop. You know what? Pursue the conversations. The only way these issues ever get traction is the volume of the conversation. Like waiting for the next person to be hurt, or the next person to be injured, or the next person to have to quit their career because of this toxicity is not the way forward. What you're doing is allowing the opportunity for people who are silent to say, that's happened to me. I need some confident way that I could be heard here too. Maybe people will reach out to you because you're doing this. But hopefully, that the people that, from a higher performing side, from a political side, will start paying attention and start asking questions. And you'll know when you've resonated with people when someone who has a lot to lose phones you and says, I'd like to talk to you. And you're doing the right things. You are simply supporting the silent people out there who are not being supported. And just don't give up on it. Persist.
Thank you so much, Roger. It has been a true pleasure, an unexpected pleasure. As I told you before, I was hesitant and I had my back up just because of your position that you held and because of my negative experiences, which is unfair to you as a person and as the leader that you're moving forward as, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I look forward to having you on again on a round table of some sort to have discussions where we can delve deep into different things. And I hope you would be open to that.
100%. And I promise I'll be better at my computer the next time I do.
We all have these IT issues. It's, COVID forced us all to get real.
All right.
Thank you so much, Roger, as well from me as well. It was just a pleasure. And speaking from a learning perspective, going back to what Lee said and having our backup and, you know, we do feel like we're in a bit of a fight here, and maybe that's not the best way to be, but I do think that, you know, it's like fight or flight. So we're in the fight. And sometimes when you're in the fight, it's hard to see someone else's perspective without getting your back up. So this was at first an uncomfortable thought. It put me in an uncomfortable position, but I'm glad I put myself here because I think the conversations we've had has been well worth it. So thank you very much.
You know what? And my last little sign off is I'm very sorry for what you both experienced. I think it's such a travesty, and it does bother me what you went through. I just hope that you should never have to defend your having your back up. This is, it's so important. If people aren't honest and don't have this, your courage, and it'll never get hurt. So I applaud you both for doing this.
Thank you. And thank you for your integrity.
Take care of yourselves.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe to the Behind Blue Doors podcast to catch the latest episodes. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And check out our website at www.behindbluedoors.org. Take care, and until next time.